It's Will Sean Podcast. The internet cried out for two more blowhards, and they courageously answered that call. Armed with the weapon of wit, each week they're joined by guests to discuss movies, television, pop culture, and anything else that's pissing them off. Take it away, boys.
I'm Will Link.
And I'm Sean David.
And this is Will Sean Podcast.
Well, is there a Grammy category for Best Comedic Podcast? How you doing, Will?
There should be.
But there's not.
And we would win it.
There are about 90,000 Grammy categories. Nothing for comedy podcasts. Not yet.
So listen, you ask how I'm doing. This, the podcast studio's north here, could explode at any minute. I've been having an electrical problem. The outlet in my kitchen all week has been making this loud clicking noise, which means there's a short.
Okay.
Which means the walls could erupt in flames. I have told my building manager about this. It has not been fixed yet. I think they're trying to kill me.
Okay, so if this episode ends unexpectedly early, you know why.
This could be our highest rated episode, the episode where we died and we took a poor guest with us.
We did take him. We're going to get to the poor guest in a moment. But
But so, we'll see. We'll live, we'll die, you know, you gotta
well,
die.
Well, that's how we do it. We're so devoted to our art that we're willing to die to put this down on computer.
Speaking of our art, what's going on in the world of Will Sean Podcast?
Facebook, Twitter, Stitcher, it's all there. Subscribe, download, tell your friends. You know the drill by now.
We've been a little stalled on the Facebook likes. Just like us.
You know what, if you want a free Christmas present, why don't you give people the gift of comedy? Tell them about the Will Sean Podcast. It won't cost you anything, and they will thank you.
Yeah, just write it on a card and just be like, I've given you a one-year subscription
to the Will Sean Podcast. There we go. You know what, Will? We should have thought of this in advance and had cards made up.
Maybe well, there's we still always will. There's always next year.
Yeah, it's true. We'll think about this. But, yeah, give the gift of comedy.
Who's our sponsor this week?
Well, maybe you've heard that the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate Middleton, herself, is preggers. Therefore, this week's episode is brought to you by the rule of full cognatic primogeniture. As you know, the rule of full cognatic primogeniture states that the eldest child, regardless of gender, inherits full land and title. This is in opposition to agnatic primogeniture, which passes inheritance among the sons of a monarch or head of family. So, regardless of what the Duchess gives birth to next year, because of full cognatic primogeniture, the child will be the next king or queen of England. But God help us all if she has twins.
Ah.
Yeah, that would be a clusterfuck. It's never happened in royal
history. I was about to ask if it's happened.
Technically, whoever pops out first would be the heir. Now, this becomes very interesting. If she has a C-section, the doctor is basically in his hands who becomes the next monarch of England.
I wouldn't say it's very interesting.
It's extremely interesting.
Yeah, we're not European.
I like it.
On the show today, Boardwalk Empire has ended. We'll be talking about that. Kubrick is big in L.A. right now. We're going to be talking about the great Stanley Kubrick. And there's a half a man who's pissing me off. But first, he is the director of the new film, The Man Who Shook the Hand of Vicente Fernandez, which is playing in theaters as we speak.
Yes.
Well, maybe not as we speak, but as you listen. And he is Aaliyah Petridis.
Hi, guys.
Welcome.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Not to be a total buzzkill, but there's no N in Vicente's name.
Vicente.
Yeah,
Fernandez.
Yeah, Vicente Fernandez. It's not Vincent. I used to make that mistake all the time.
So don't go buy tickets for the man who shook the hand of Vicente Fernandez. Make sure you are seeing the man who shook the hand of Vicente Fernandez.
Yeah, you know what really bugs me about
the one with the
N,
that's going to be the porno version, right?
Yeah, we're right. Yeah. We have to keep the N one separate so we can make that film.
Well, what really bugs
me? It really bugs me. No, not bugs me, but the one thing I've noticed that's incredible is that, you know, there's an accent on the A in Nandez.
Yeah.
And none of the theater chains can list it because they can't figure out how to turn their keyboards to Spanish with the open bracket sign and get that accent on the A.
I can't complain because I wouldn't know how to do it
either.
Yeah,
I find that extremely problematic.
Some theaters in Los Angeles would have figured that out.
Right? I would think so. I would imagine so anyway. I noticed that, though. It's sort of funny. As it started to end up in print and reviews and, like, listings and stuff like that, nobody's got that A.
So nobody's quite getting the
title. Yeah, exactly.
Ralph Pignon had it.
Right?
Yeah.
I thought so. Those guys know where it belongs.
Let's take a step back. Let's talk about this movie.
Sure.
Give us the quick 10-second synopsis of what it's about.
Okay, it's a Western set in a nursing home.
There you have
That's
it.
Concise. And you were nice enough to give us a screener of this beforehand, and we both thought it was just a lot of fun.
Yep.
I love you said it's a Western set in a nursing home, and I love how you play with a lot of the Western tropes, the black hat, white hat kind of thing in this setting of this nursing home.
Well, even so much as the opening credits, I started laughing out loud when I was watching it because it's a direct spoof of the Sergio Leone, Good, Bad, and the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars credits.
Sure, I'm nodding my head, but
yeah.
This is an audible medium, right?
Yes, correct.
Well, I mean, are you a big Western fan? Were you really inspired by Westerns?
Not particularly. No, I'm not particularly a Western fan.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like you wouldn't walk into my apartment and find it lined wall to wall with Westerns. I find the Man with No Name trilogy.
Yeah.
Particularly difficult to watch.
Okay.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I think the visuals are stunning.
Mm-hmm.
I think the score obviously is stunning. My favorite Leone film is Once Upon a Time in America.
Yes.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
Love that movie.
His version, obviously, not the version that Pauline Kael ripped to shreds when it first came out, but his ultimate version. But I find the plot of the trilogy very difficult to stay engaged in.
Well, it's a little thin.
Right?
The plots a little thin, and the movies are very formalized.
It's almost like a mutable movie, right? In that way. You can sort of, as long as the visuals are playing.
But the music,
that's sort of
too,
what compels
so
me. Yeah, that's right. You're right. You're right.
Of
Morricone
the three,
is...
Not to spin off too much, but of the three, the one I actually like the most is the middle one for a few dollars.
Same
more.
Here, actually. That's my favorite. Cool. And I know it's not popular because The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly is the classic. And the end of that movie is so great. But I think for a whole movie, because I don't think it... I think The Good, Bad, and the Ugly sometimes overstays its welcome,
mm-hmm.
you know?
It drags a bit.
I would agree.
Yep.
I would agree.
Let's get back to this.
Please.
This movie stars the late, great Ernest Borgnine, who just passed away this summer, and you had the privilege and the opportunity of working with him
on this
movie. How did he get involved with the project?
He got involved in the project through the legendary casting director, Ronnie Eskel.
Okay.
Who cast Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, and The Sessions, actually, which is currently playing, which was called The Surrogate at the time.
Okay.
And she took a shining to the script very early on. We got very lucky. We got two champions of the movie. We got Panavision on board very early, which let us shoot 35.
Wow.
And we got Ronnie.
I noticed that.
We got Ronnie on board, which got us access to... not so much got us access to people, but legitimized us as a project, really. Without those two very early pillars, I don't think... You know, obviously we wouldn't have gone as far as we've gone.
Right.
But it was through Ronnie that we managed to get to people like Ernie and Dale and Barry and Carla, et cetera, et cetera. So she really put together a wonderful cast. It's quite illuminating to see what the casting director's role is, because there's a real art to that
that I think
is kind of unsung in a way. And the movie opened at the Lemley, is going to open at the Lemley Town Center 5 on Friday. And next door, The Sessions will be playing.
So she'll have
two movies in one Cineplex. And I wrote her an email yesterday saying you're the first casting mogul that I know.
Every movie in the theater
was cast by me.
That's it. I own all these auditoriums.
So now she obviously gets you to Borgnine, but he's got to read the script. He's got to take a liking to this material, then,
right.
I guess. So how did that go? How did meeting him? Because, I mean, this is... A legendary film star.
Yes, very much so. We got the okay to drop off the script. And Ernie used to live up in Mulholland,
mm-hmm.
up in the hills. So we drove all the way up there. I remember it was me and Timur and Darren, I think, and I. And we drove up there, and the gates were closed, and we hit the buzzer. And he said, "Leave it in the mailbox. I'm in bed." And it was 6 p.m. I think.
Some
6 in the afternoon.
Auspicious star.
Yeah.
Leave it in the mailbox. I think he was in bed. He was under the weather, and so we did. And he read it, and obviously the word came down that he wanted to meet the director. So when I went to meet him, one of the many things he said to me on that wonderful first meeting, because there's a lot of cool stories on that first meeting. One of the things he said to me was, "I read your script 4 times, and I didn't get it." I don't get it.
Great.
but my publicist, Harry Flynn, really gets it. And my personal assistant, who Joyce, who was very close with him, really gets it. And I've shown it to a few other people, and they all think that I really have to do this movie. So I read it 3-4 more times, and I get it. That's what he said to me. You know, because when he read the script, it was very meta.
Yeah.
It was very self-reflexive.
Yeah.
Right. You know what I mean? You know, the opening credit sequence is actually the first page of the script. That's all written out, you know. And so it very much was self-aware that it was a film and that it was a Western. And so that kind of, like, metaphysical approach for Ernie, I think, was strange. It was kind of odd, even though he came about in the 70s when self-reflexive cinema was kind of being born, really. He really didn't understand sort of the look back.
Yeah, I mean, he's an old-school guy.
He's an old-school guy. But Harry Flynn walked into the room during that meeting and said, "Oh, you know, it's so nice to meet you. I love the script." And he said, "This is a coda. This is a coda to Ernie's career."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I said to him, "Well, I've written the coda, but I've been looking for a symphony to add it on to."
Yeah.
So there wouldn't really be anything without that prior work, because I always knew that I wanted there to be a relationship between the audience and Rex.
Right.
Of melancholy, because the person playing him was a Western movie star or had a track record in that genre. And I always wanted the audience to connect with Rex in that way and have that self-reflexive experience. We went out to a few other people. However, being as young as I was and sort of not being able to, in my mind's eye, visualize the difference. It's hard for me when I first, I know this very clearly now, but when I first write in the script, it's very difficult for me to visualize the difference between a 75-year-old and an 89-year-old, for example.
Yeah.
Or an 89-year-old and a 96-year-old. Really, it was very hard for me to visualize what the physical differences are and also what the spiritual differences are at that age. And I realized very quickly that if I went to anybody too young, they weren't going to want to do it because they didn't feel that they were there.
Right.
So when we eliminated the age group and we kind of circled our wagons casting-wise, Ernie was the only man on earth that could do it. Because of his age and because of his career. You know what I mean?
He's in the Wild Bunch.
Right.
Right.
You know, you're like you said, he's this great Western actor.
But I got really lucky as a green director in that sense. I got really lucky that the stars aligned.
Going back to that idea, you know, this film takes place primarily in an old age home. Most of the cast is elderly. And you're a young guy.
Mm.
Did that present any unique problems in terms of having to get their respect or having them second guess you, or was everyone pretty much on board?
No, the problems that it really presented to me was in the writing phase.
Yeah.
Because
you're not
everything in that first everything in that first draft was reeked of fakeness and sincerity. And partly because of first draft, I really believe that you don't really know what you're writing until you hit the end on your first draft. I really believe that a first draft is not to be shown or vetted to anybody. It should go straight back to page one and rewrite it again. But part of that was that I couldn't, as the writer, I didn't know what aspect of my soul I was trying to communicate. And when I narrowed in on the theme of regret, what regret meant to me as a young man, and meant to someone as an old man, when I found that connective tissue, then everything in the script started to feel authentic and started to ring truer. Once that was out of the way, people resonated with that because it had an element of soul and an element of truth to it. That was really the big... And I remember this very clearly. I was in my kitchen doing the dishes, and I said, "What the heck do I know at 29, 28, about Rex at 95? What do I know? I don't know." You know, and I had to really sit down and soul search and say, how am I going to make this true? How is it going to be real? Because I had the idea. I had the cinematic, the film grammar, right? I had the shots.
Yes.
You didn't have the emotional grammar.
The moments. The And I knew, you know, I knew the ending, and I knew where I wanted the audience to end up. But there was no substance yet, no connective tissue until I really sat down and said, because I feel like every film is a thesis. You know,
it's an argument.
It's an argument. I mean, regardless of the thesis, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
No, but more in the terms of you're arguing a point, and this is my premise.
Right.
And the film itself plays out, and it proves
and it tests that premise from every angle of a prism.
Right.
I think. And so once I arrived at the theme of regret and redemption, and realized that every scene now merely had to exert tension onto that theme.
Yeah.
you know, exert itself onto it and see how it fared against it, then that started to give the script an element of truth. And that's what that was my biggest challenge. Once I got on the set, I didn't get much, like, you know, Ernie is such a gentleman that he is so cognitive of his place in the hierarchy of a film set. And of how his talents collaborate with everybody else's talents, he doesn't see himself any more than the art director or the production designer or the props master or the makeup. He's there to collaborate with all
the
different elements.
He understands. I mean, we're talking about a guy who's been on so many film sets.
For
and
70
he just
plus
really
years.
Has a, such a
Absolutely.
Sense.
And we know we got him a trailer.
Yeah.
It was a really small budget. But we got Ernie a trailer. He never used it. They needed it to the makeup girls. I've told this story. He would always stay at the edge of the set because he said that Jimmy Stewart never left the set. And if it was good enough for Jimmy, it was good enough for him. And That's he didn't want to be the one to be waited on. At 94 years old.
Wow.
You know, we tried to keep him nourished, tried to keep him fed. You know, he didn't want to be – he just wanted to work, man. He just wanted to be on there working.
Man, well, I can't even do that, and I'm, you know.
Yeah, right? I know. Where'd there you go. I'd be like, oh, I gotta get out of
this shit.
Take me to my trailer.
Yeah. We're not the pros Ernest Borgnine.
Ernie was a pro. So much so, can I finish that thought? Quickly, sorry. Is that I sent him the director's cut of the film, and he was completely confused. He would say to me, "Why? What have I got to do with it?"
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I said, well, I'd love your notes. You've made over 200 movies. I don't know how to direct.
This is my job.
This is not my gig. You know?
Well, to get a little bit more into the plot, because Ernest's character, he's brought to this old age home, and he had never quite made it as like a Western actor, and he's kind of looking for a one more chance to be a hero, one more chance to be a star, and the people who work in this nursing home, they start to take a shine to him because he is this man who shook the hand of Vicente. Oh, my God. I'm bad with names.
It's all right.
Okay,
that was the first six months of my life on this project. Don't worry about it.
Well, he shook his hand.
Yeah.
And this is a man that they admire. So he becomes kind of a celebrity, and eventually he goes, well, I don't want to give away, but there's a chance that...
Redemption
and heroics.
Vicente Fernandez, for those of you who don't know, is basically the Mexican Frank Sinatra, and he's actually still alive and performs regularly. And
yeah, just did his farewell tour.
Yeah.
Auspiciously.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he's anything like Barbara Streisand, there'll be about five more of those.
I hope so. I hope the reasons why he did it are a complete fallacy and rumor. I won't go into them, but I hope he has five more.
Okay.
From your lips to God's ears.
Well, Ernest's character... he becomes kind of a celebrity, and I think that it was such, I mean, obviously making this, you didn't know it would be his last role, but I think it is a perfect, kind of, you were saying, Code of the Girl, perfect ending because of this character. He's getting one more shot at stardom, and it was also, one of the things I always liked about Ernest as an actor was he was perfect at playing this mix of teddy bear and tough SOB, and this was one of those roles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So,
Ernie loved to laugh on screen.
He
smile. Loved it. Ah, ha, ha, he loved that, and I think he had done, you know, the last lap of his career was, you know, Lifetime stuff.
Yeah,
really feel good stuff. Like he did a film called Love's Christmas Journey, I think, at some, which is, you know, he plays, you know, he pulled me aside and said, get this, don't tell anyone, but I play a character. And his name is Nicholas. You know, he would tell you these really cute stories, you know? Don't tell anyone, but I'm St. Nick. I'm Santa Claus in the picture.
And you look spoiler alert, Ernie.
You know? Yeah, right? I mean, he would tell you these great stories. So the thing about Ernie is that he loved to laugh and emote joy on screen because he felt like he really connected with his audience that way. So it was a very intended thing to take him back behind the line in that first act to get him as grouchy and as grumpy. That was not as easy as you think. I know he's played a lot of bad guys, Emperor of the North and so on and so forth, really obviously From Here to Eternity, etc. But you know, he had to sort of be reminded how to get back in that curmudgeonly shell so that I could, you know, by the end of the third act have him, you know, arc out properly where I wanted him.
Right.
You know, he was always tempted to be joyful all the time, and we
like,
had
no,
to.
You got
to
start
yeah,
your character.
You got to start. Yeah. You got to start crusty, and we'll go from there.
I was always such a fan of his from being a kid because I was a big Poseidon Adventure fan
yeah.
as a kid, and I think that's one of those great where he's the character's both lovable but a pain, like a pain in the ass kind of thing. When he died, a couple of friends of mine, we had a movie marathon. We did an Ernest Borgnine,
oh,
where
cool.
we watched like the Poseidon Adventure and Marty and a bunch of films.
I love Marty. I didn't see Marty till recently, actually, and the movie just hit me. It's
yeah.
like it's such an emotional powerhouse. It's
you know
like
what's crazy about that
gut.
Movie is that it's a James L. Brooks, it's a Cameron Crowe.
Oh, it, yeah. oh it's not. It certainly
before
is.
Before those, you know what I mean? Like, it does that make you laugh, make you cry, same time kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, Billy Wilder was doing it, you know, but it really sort of falls into that genre that we can't quite, you know, it's an auteur-driven genre, but we can't quite put our finger on why we're laughing 1 minute and crying
right.
the next minute and laughing 1 minute.
Now, we're talking a lot about Ernest for obvious reasons, the star of the film, but there's a lot of other great actors in this film. Barry Corbin,
yeah.
who I used to like a lot on Northern Exposure. I always thought he was great on that show. And Dale Dickey, who is an actress who's been getting a lot of attention lately, too. She was in Winter's Bone. She was excellent in.
Yep.
She's been on a lot of sitcoms like My Name is Earl.
Yep. She chewed the scenery in True Blood last season, I think. She was a werewolf
yeah. Oh, yeah.
matriarch or something.
She is, yeah. She's on that show. She's terrific on that. She's got a great look. Like, she's got a, like, she
really
stands
lived
out.
Yeah.
She was in Being Flynn, I think, with Robert De Niro. And
I didn't see yeah. it, but yeah. So, I mean, did they come on after you got Ernest, or were they involved earlier? Like, where did they come in?
It's funny you should mention Dale, because Dale is a good example of one of the tenets of our casting choices, which was because we were making a Western,
yeah.
we wanted great faces.
Yeah.
We just
and
wanted,
you have great faces.
Everywhere we point the camera, we wanted it to be a great face. You know?
Yeah.
And so when Dale came in to read, although I knew her work, I wasn't looking to cast her against type or anything.
Yeah.
I was just, she just came in and she just had a great face, like a Western face. And she was a fabulous actress, so she
yeah.
can play anything. You know? So it was just like the right circumstances to have her be a soccer mom in that way, because I was looking for Western faces. Barry Corbin, Carlo Ortiz, Arturo Del Puerto. I mean, like, these
very
guys
Western.
Have faces, you
well,
know, to look at.
You know, and Dale Dickey really is against type, because you have, like in fucking Winter's Bone, she's
right.
like hillbilly in the Ozarks kind
right.
of thing. And,
right.
and on True Blood, she's kind of a hillbilly, but this one, she just got to be a regular person.
Right.
Like a really real person. Another thing with the film that we were just reading before you, well, right when you got here, right, off air, a Spanish language review, and we were talking about how this is a good film for like a Hispanic community too, where it doesn't portray, usually these films portray like Mexican drug dealers and stuff
right.
like this, but this is just good people working in a nursing home. Like it's good for that community as well. Like, was that did that come from the Western idea, or was that like a world you wanted to visit, like I don't want to say, what's the word I'm looking for, not ethnicity, but a culture that
yes.
you had an interest in?
Good question. I mean, look, you're a product of your circumstance sometimes. I did critical theory as an undergrad right at USC, so I always think of films like this. You know, even if they're very, very popcorny, I always know that there's the potential that if you want to interpret a text differently, or really look at it from a socio or an economic or political point of view, you
can.
Right. Text can have that conversation.
Yeah.
So when I'm writing, it's not always the level of intent that I go for, but it's definitely, I know that there's a dialogue happening. Right? So with the history of the Western, I know that there's a dialogue happening. And one of the things that I want to do very consciously was, you know, the Western in its moving parts is historically about, you know, the white man taming the other when it's
yeah.
reduced, you know, either the, you know, either the Indian or the bandito or, you know, whatever it is, or the other lawless white man or whatever. But it's, you know, the other as a metaphor for untamed wilderness, manifest destiny, getting all the way to the ocean, right? Staking
yeah.
your claim. So, I knew that I was going to turn that on its head here. I knew that I was going to have the white man being tamed by the other.
Ah.
You see?
Yeah.
The only thing that is prickly when you set out to do something like that is because you are making a film that knows it's a film, in this case, and it's drawing on cinematic grammar, right? There is, unfortunately, this history in the Western genre of how Latino people factor in.
Right?
Portrayed. So the fact that he comes in and they need saving, I find is problematic. However, it is a trope and a series of choices that have been established way before me, and it's something that I am expanding upon that conversation. You see what I'm saying? Did I want to make a movie about the overcrowding of the healthcare system? Heck no. I just wanted an allegory for a good small town, and I thought Rancho Park, the nursing home, was perfect.
Right.
Do people read into that? Hell yes. I just screened the film for the USC School of Gerontology.
Okay.
Right? Okay? Who read it as a text specifically on nursing homes, the healthcare system, and overcrowding.
Which you are an expert on.
Well, I'm not an expert on, but it's not the point. I mean, it's not the main emotional drive of the movie. However, the allegory and the metaphor of the small town begets all those other elements. So when you're struggling with problem solving in the screenwriting phase, sometimes you open up conversations later to come that will come and bite you in the ass later on when you make the movie, right? Yeah. So, you know, so it's not as easy as your question. The answer is far more complex because
It always is.
I was screening at the DGA and I got called out. Somebody put their hand up, a Hispanic woman put their hand up and said to me, maybe if you had made this film in 1940s, but how dare you get away with this film today?
Wow.
I there's going to be a drug pusher next or a pimp or a prostitute. You know, you've got every racial stereotype in this movie. And what I wanted to say to her was, you're misusing your words because I have every racial slur in this movie, but all my stereotypes are actually archetypes. I mean, my characters are trained professionals, doctors, nurses, you know what I mean? So, okay, yes, so Rex in that first act, we take him way back behind the line. You know, because he's
racist.
He's racist in the movie. Yeah, and he's insensitive, right? I mean, but you know, who hasn't seen Gran Torino?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's a genre there. There's a model there, especially for a rite of passage kind of a structure.
It's called the Republican Party.
Right. It's like that. Yeah. Huh? Okay. Cool.
But how did you answer this woman?
Well, no. What I said to her was, well, because here's the thing: is that I said to her, look, I was always taught that comedy diffuses tension. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was always, and I think political correctness kills art. I really do. And so, you know, take it or leave it. You know, I feel like her being so perturbed by the film legitimized it.
Okay.
You know,
you touched a nerve, and there was
touched a nerve. She was so, you know, but she was right in starting that dialogue because it's a dialogue that is implicit in the film. I think it's there, but I don't think she seemed to have come in fuzzed and ready to fight. Regardless,
some people are just looking for her.
But the one thing that I will say that we shouldn't not touch upon, because you were asking me this earlier, was Vicente Fernandez and his sincerity in the way he relates to the Latino people.
Okay.
Okay. America is an ironic culture.
Yes.
Okay. But Greece, Lebanon, Mexico. France, Italy, these are people that have much bigger slices of culture where they relate to content in a very, very, very sincere way.
And that was something I definitely picked up on the movie, the earnestness and the sincereness and the lack of irony in the movie.
But the way that they relate to him, the way that the staff relate to Vicente is very real. And it's a real world phenomenon that still happens today. You know, Pierre.
That he's worshipped like
this. Pierre, who originally told me the story as a joke that happened to him. This happened to him. People ran across from the hospital he was in to meet him. The funny thing about Vicente was that he used to be a custodian in a nursing home.
Really?
Oh,
before
wow.
he started his career. So there you go.
So it's full circle for him, too.
Talk about metaphysical. Yeah.
So where can people see...
Before we move on to the topics of the week that we do on the show...
I'm supposed to be funny. Is that right? Not boring? Is that correct?
No, 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 no.
Good.
This is interesting.
Okay.
In the interview, you're supposed to be interesting.
Okay, good. Okay, I'll try and be funny.
We genuinely want you to push your product, and with that in mind, because it's a terrific film, where can people go see this film? Where can they see this?
They can see it currently opening Friday, December 7th at the Lemley Town Center in Encino.
Okay.
The Town Center 5.
And this episode...
Showtimes are available right now.
This episode comes up the movie should already be out.
Yes.
So if you're a really good listener, you've already gone to see this movie.
And on Saturday night, you're going to be doing a Q&A there, and we will also have the details up on the site.
That's true. After which I'll be doing a Q&A with a select cast and my producers and Pierre Gounod, who's the original man who shook the hand of Vicente Fernandez. The original person.
He'll be there.
The guy who told me this story in the first place that sparked the imagination for the whole film. Because that's the number one question I get asked. So I figured to quell all these concerns, I'm going to bring up
this is
Pierre
like he just stands up
stage.
There and he can't see you on the podcast.
Yeah, he's
going
to hold his hand.
I'm holding my hand to the sky. There we go.
Now, and one more question. Is there any future plans? Maybe like video on demand? Any future plans?
Oh, absolutely. After it plays theatrically, we'll see what the sort of, you know, once it's done its first blush, we'll see if Lemley wants to take it around or if other, like, retirement communities in the country maybe would like to show it, like Boca Raton or Phoenix or, Texas or, you know, wherever we think it might play. And then, obviously, we'll go to all other ancillary revenues, which is, you know, iTunes, Redbox, Best Buy, Kmart, yeah. Walmart, on demand, etc.
Me and Sean had a lot of fun with this.
Liked it. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks,
you
Sean.
Definitely.
It's the first I heard of you. I've been sitting here in pins and needles all night.
About what?
I didn't even know you watched it.
I watched it. Of course I watched it.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah,
thank you.
Both watched it.
Thank you so much. That's
and
cool.
We...
How do you know I knew plot point? How else did the guy
well,
do
yeah,
plot
I mean, I surmised once we started. I didn't get anything of it at all.
We do our homework.
It is a fun film.
Yeah.
I mean, Ernest is great. The film's great. Just go. Get off your fucking asses and go see the movie.
I'm so flattered that you guys watched it because, really, you guys are cinephiles. And I'm so happy. You know, I really want to start here with you guys.
Excellent.
And people who are movie lovers. This is a movie for movie lovers.
Well, since you two are a cinephile, I wanted to talk about this on the show this week. And I mentioned it in the opening. I am a huge Stanley Kubrick fan.
Cool.
And anyone who lives here in Los Angeles probably knows, because you can't avoid, there's signs all over
right.
with Jack Nicholson's face on them in
and
The Shining.
And
Malcolm McDowell's face on them, and
the
blanking
twins,
who played Lolita, but her face on them too.
Blondie McSexy body.
And
the third.
It is at LACMA here, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, They are doing a Stanley Kubrick retrospective, and I have seen this exhibit. It's phenomenal. If you love Kubrick, you have to go see it. They have not just like props from the film, like they have the typewriter from The Shining, which is just cool to see, but also they have pages of his scripts.
Yeah.
And one of the things, like, I'm looking at scripts with, like, the notes, like, on Lolita, and in the margins you see doodles of, like, airplanes.
A lot of
and
racial
I'm like,
slurs.
Well, no. But you see, like, doodles of airplanes, and I kept thinking, like, was he thinking about Strangelove? Like, is that why there's an airplane doodled in these page notes? And things like that, yeah. I know you saw this as well. What
did
you think of
the exhibit? Yeah, I was fortunate enough to go to the press opening for it, and so I kind of had it. Not all to myself, but we had it, you know, it was a nice room. And
without all of Los Viles there as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, because Christian was, like, in a corner doing an interview, and, like, his brother-in-law, Jan, was in a corner doing an interview. So it was, like, we was kind of, like, hallowed ground. And I was trying to eavesdrop on Christian and what she was saying. And one of the funny things she was saying, which she was so right, is that, you know, he never made a movie with a computer. Kubrick died before all of that really took off.
Oh, that's true.
Special effects.
You know. Yeah. He made a movie with a computer
right.
in
sorry,
it.
Sorry, but he didn't. I know what you mean. Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, he made the ultimate computer movie, but he never used the computer to make a movie. You know, and that really, I feel like that's one of the defining factors of Kubrick, interestingly.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about. Especially also there's a section where they have conceptual artwork from AI, which
that's
is...
That's probably why he handed
that
off.
Maybe that's why he never got it made. I think it may be overwhelmed him, or it was just he didn't understand the world enough.
I don't know about overwhelmed. If I have a hard time imagining Kubrick being
overwhelmed,
but
maybe
he definitely put it in the right hands.
I mean, he also
that's
seemed
a whole other conversation.
Well, correct. Although I do know people for whom that's their favorite Spielberg film.
I will tell you this. Fuck the haters. I love AI.
There you go.
I absolutely love that film. I won't. We won't. You know, get
that's
it.
That's all. Sorry, Zach Fox.
Yeah, I think it's a tremendously interesting film. I think it actually has a really great Hale Joel Osment performance. But Kubrick, you will get a kick when you go to see this, Sean.
I haven't seen it yet because I'm waiting to see it with somebody. So.
There's lenses. There's slates. There's. Yeah.
Well, my favorite Kubrick movie is Barry Lyndon. I'm obsessed with that movie. I love it.
They have the costumes out there. They also have the book Barry Lyndon with some of his notes in the book.
Yeah, okay. And they have a huge Napoleon section.
Well, that's where I was going to get to, which I think you'll find fascinating. There's a whole room devoted to his never-made Napoleon film, and the library. It's ridiculous. The library. He has, like, a whole card catalog of just different Napoleon people Napoleon knew. In fact, it's unbelievable. This man put so much work into a film that never made. I mean, ugh.
Well, I heard that actually the Napoleon movie is getting picked up and is being made by Brett Ratner of all
Brett
people.
Brett Ratner's
oh,
Napoleon.
Fantastic.
Brett Ratner's
going to
pick up the mantle.
Go the
yeah, he's
oh, got
Brett Ratner's Napoleon.
With great. Chris Tucker as Napoleon.
As Napoleon's black friend.
There is the one. Is...
Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
There you go.
That would be.
Can't
you know
wait.
What? Now I actually do want to see the Brett Ratner Napoleon film. I do want
to
see.
Yeah, so I definitely need to go see this. I went to LACMA and I thought I was in the Kubrick exhibit. Turned out it was Robert Mapplethorpe. Very, very different.
Oh,
so, yeah.
I would say a little bit different.
A little
I've been
bit.
Spending a lot of time at LACMA because we're shooting this thing with Barry, Metropolis 2, centered around the installation there.
Yeah,
in
the
Metropolis
Hot Wheels.
2. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's why I got lucky enough to go to the press opening because I've been liaisoning a lot with them.
Yeah.
Barry's talent, obviously, never ceases. I mean, I'm constantly amazed by him.
I say you plan yourself a big cinephile day. You go see the film, The Man Who Shook the Hand of...
Vicente Fernandez.
And then you go to see the Kubrick exhibit.
Right.
It'd be the greatest day of your
right.
life.
If you have to choose, go see the Kubrick exhibit.
And,
and
I must put in a plug, they currently have an exhibit at the LACMA, which I've gone to see three times now. It's 18th century French ceramics, and I'm not joking, this stuff is fascinating. Porcelain and ceramics, I'm obsessed with decorative arts, and tea sets, and cups, and spoons, and all this shit.
It's a very dainty exhibit.
It's a lot of hard paste and soft paste porcelain. Fascinating stuff. If you want, I'll go with you to go see the.
I'll go with you.
We'll message.
See some teacups. I don't. That sounds great.
Message the podcast, and Sean will bring you to the teacups. He will show you the teacups.
I will show you some phenomenal 1740s hard paste.
By the
porcelain.
Way, it's very rare that we get to the topic of teacups
right.
on the podcast, but we did today.
Yeah, well, here we are.
Porcelain. Well, I'm gonna move
moving on, from my
on to the teacup beach here.
Us on the podcast, we're big fans of the show Boardwalk Empire. Have you seen the show?
No, I haven't. Not one frame of it.
Are
I
you
know that
Scorsese
produced.
Are you willing to watch it? Because we're going to watch three seasons of it right now.
Go for it. Nope. Go for it. I'm ready. Go for it.
Well, they just had their season 3 finale. And real quick, I thought it was tremendous. I thought it was a tremendous season for them. It ended, I think, on a really high note. And the character of Richard Harrow is so fucking badass. If you don't watch the show, watch it.
You know who the actor is that plays Richard Harrow? He is
Jack Houston.
Who is the
son of John Houston.
No, of Angelica Houston.
The grandson,
of John Houston. The great-grandson of Walter Houston. Which means that if he wins an Academy Award for some future work, there'll be four generations of Houstons winning Academy Awards.
Well, he's got to get on this shit.
He's so fucking good. The show has had, real quickly, it was his strongest season. I had some problems with it in the second season. It fixed a lot of that. It feels like the show finally really came into its own.
Is it because they let Nucky become a gangster this season,
finally? I think it was part
finally?
Of it. I think they got rid of some of the characters that were dragging elements of the show down.
Aaliyah, there's a character on the show in the first two seasons, this character, Jimmy Doherty. And everybody apparently loved Jimmy Doherty, except me and Sean.
Poor man's Leonardo DiCaprio.
Who does Michael Pitt play?
Jimmy Doherty.
I love that actor.
He was fine, but I started to get a little sick of the character. I felt like the character had nowhere to go.
Yeah.
Character was not on this season. And without ruining why, he wasn't on this past season.
And it was stronger for it.
And I think the show... But people have been like, nah, I miss Jimmy Doherty.
Nah.
Fuck you. It was better with
Harris.
I
mean,
he mysteriously disappeared in a gangster show?
Yeah. That's only second to mysteriously disappearing in a zombie show. That's why I would never want to be in a zombie project. You open your mouth once, you complain, they'll be like,
right.
You get eaten.
It's an easy show to write you off of.
Exactly. Right. So, yeah, but Boardwalk Empire.
The AD comes over, he's like, walk slower.
Yeah, walks, exactly. Boardwalk Empire, if you're a fan, if you're not a fan, it's a good show, and really, I love these shows that have just been getting better with each subsequent season, and this is an example of that.
I love it. I love it.
How do you find, like, the wardrobe on that show?
Everything is impeccable. Yeah. All the production design is amazing.
And if you watch the pilot with Scorsese directed, it is one of the most cinematic television experiences
yeah,
you're going to get.
I definitely will check it out.
And it's a lush movie. They don't spare any expense. HBO, for all their Deadwood, Rome, any show of theirs that takes place in not today.
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones.
But are you going to tell me that any of the show you just listed is going to even hold a candle to what's going on American Horror Story right now?
Don't watch it.
I don't watch it.
Okay. Josh, you're just missing the best TV in history.
Overcooked nonsense.
What?
Overcooked nonsense.
Says the guy who
hasn't watched AHS?
I'm not a conoscenti, but yes.
Well, you know it's an anthology, right?
Yes.
I mean, you know that they don't relate.
Yes.
So it's a mini series.
Each season is a horror story.
Yeah.
In essence.
And this has been a fantastic. This season's been fantastic.
Well, I mean, it's a complex discussion about homophobia, homosexuality, xenophobia. I mean,
it is Ryan Murphy.
Yeah. It tackles all the complex, the horror of the internal manifest externally, just like they used to do it in the 70s.
Like it's Rosemary's
smart.
Baby and
it's exactly.
Which is always my favorite kind
smart
of horror film.
70s horror every week, Wednesday night, 10 o'clock.
Which one
FX.
Has,
awesome.
What's his name, jerking off to the television? Which season was that?
I think that's season one.
Yeah. Season one. Who's
the actor?
Dermot Mulroney.
Dermot Mulroney.
Oh, yeah.
Mulroney.
Who's
yeah.
great in that show. By
no,
way.
Dylan McDermott.
Yeah, cool. Good
Dermot
enough.
Mulroney's the other one.
Whoever plays the Patriarch, which I think I know which character you're referring to, is great in that show. By the way, that show will leave you pluriant and ready in season one.
Okay.
Because they don't really fuck with that in season two. It's not about sexuality. But season one will leave you aroused. After every episode, it is so sexy.
I've seen some stills of a maid.
The redheaded maid.
The redheaded maid.
Wow.
She left me aroused.
I got my catalog
yeah,
of my French porcelains. I don't need American Horror Story.
Yeah, he's
but,
just a...
No. But you have. But she. But you know, it's a ghost. I mean, it's a ghost. It's a ghost, and so she has different forms. Mm. It's very cool.
I'm gonna jerk off to a redheaded maid. You could go. Come in a teacup.
It's not about the maid. It's about what she says and how she says it and how she puts herself out there.
The
you guys got to watch that show. You're missing
I need Look, to be I... careful what I say because I respect all women and do not view them
who,
as sexual objects.
Who do you respect the most? What woman do you respect the most?
Yeah, good question.
Andrea Marchand.
Exactly. You know, I
don't know who that is.
She does.
She's the voice of the podcast. When you listen back to the podcast, there'll be a wonderful, soothing female voice.
A dulcet
voice at the
tone,
beginning.
And that'll
yes.
be her.
Oh, cool.
There's one topic I want to try to squeeze in.
We're squeezing now?
I want to squeeze this one thing in because then I'm going to go crazy on something else. We only have an hour.
Oh, we do?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
All right. I was going to pour another drink.
But I'm going to try to squeeze this in. I recently, because I you're... such a cinephile. I recently wrote this article for U1 Can, and it was it asked a morbid question. You know, there are all these lists of like, what movies do you want to see before you die? What movie do you want to? But I asked the question because when I'm dying, when I'm in my last breaths, I want to be wheeled into a movie theater. I want to die in like the movie theater and have the usher just clean up my bones. And the question I asked, what movie do I want to watch as I die?
Oh, wow.
And for me, going back to Kubrick, the answer was simple. 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Not Killer's Kiss?
Not Killer's Kiss. Not Spartacus.
No.
But no. 2001, A Space Odyssey. Because I'm not a spiritual person, but there's something spiritual, I think, about that film. And there's this idea of rebirth.
Yeah, but what if you die in the first 10 minutes?
Well, I gotta hold out.
You're gonna assume that you're gonna die during this interstellar travel sequence.
I'm gonna assume that I die...
What if you die when the monkeys are bashing each other, you know, to pieces?
Well, then I'm in trouble. I gotta hold out. I gotta hold out till I hear those last.
You gotta wait till. Yeah, exactly.
And I gotta see because I feel if I see that star child on screen, maybe I will be transported and reborn as a star child. So I gotta ask
you. But you already are somewhere.
Well, I don't know. It depends what you believe.
Okay.
I believe in nothing. I believe I'll just rot in the dirt. But I want to be a star child, and I feel my best bet is to die while watching this film. So I have to ask you guys, you cinephiles, you're dying. I could put a DVD on or something. Mm-hmm. As you're dying, what do you want to be watching?
Sean?
Me?
Let me mull this over.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Excellent answer.
Really? Why?
It's fun. It's happy. I enjoy
it. You just want to have a good time.
I want to have a good time, and I want something familiar, and it's like a warm blanket. Either that or... I don't know, what's one of my other fucked up... Oliver Stone's Alexander, the director's
cut. Oh my goodness.
Well, you know, it's funny because somebody had said Jedi. Okay. Return of the Jedi. And I totally get that because that's probably a trilogy they grew up on. It's the end. It's happy.
Not
it's
Kingdom
fun.
Of the Crystal Skull?
Yeah, no, don't die on that. Do you got something?
Two.
Give them
I'll hit
me.
You with two. One, you're going to hate.
Okay.
Probably, you're going to hate this. It's going to oust me. Scent of a Woman.
Hoo-ah.
Hoo-ah.
Okay. Okay. I like the film.
There's the scene when he's driving the Ferrari blind.
Well, any moment in that film. Any moment in that film.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not counting on the ending. I'm counting that I could die, you know, inciting incident. you know.
What's the reason for it?
Just because
just like
it's the first film that really, like, when I started it as a child and when the film was over, I was a grown-up.
That makes sense.
Really?
You know? Yeah.
I can see
it
that.
It hit me at an age, at a right age. And I've never seen the Italian version. I've never seen the original. But it hit me at a particular age that when I went into it, I was one thing. And when I came out of that
for
movie
me, that movie
for the
was
first
Trainspotting.
Time, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could imagine that.
Yeah.
Fargo was a little bit along the same lines for me in that year. Yeah.
I mean,
96.
I obviously didn't see this when it came out, but I feel like I don't know, Clockwork Orange, it made me look at the world a little differently, filmmaking differently.
Yeah, but I grew up in Dubai where there were no movie theaters until late 99, 2000.
Oh.
So all my movies I was getting shipped by my dad on Laserdisc from Boston while he was doing post-grad work.
Oh, wow.
So that's how I got a hold
of Laserdisc.
Yeah, right.
And what was your second movie?
Blazing Saddles.
Oh, well, that's going out with a laugh. That's one of the funniest movies. That is an argument that could be the funniest movie
I mean,
ever.
The sheriff is there, ding! That's come on, that scene is
I
amazing.
I love the scene. And again, this isn't going to play on the podcast, but I love the scene where he's talking to Gene Wilder. He's like, look at my hand, like steady as a rock. But I shoot with this hand. And he's shaking the hand.
I love the scene where it's work, 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 work. And he signs the boobs. And he signs the boobs. And it's true. It's true. Oh, my God.
Well, moving on to comedy that is not nearly as good as Blazing Saddles.
Right.
There's a little show called 2.5 Men, which seems to always be in the news. People are always talking about this. Why? Because people work on the show apparently go crazy and want off the show. Maybe it's working with John Cryer, former enemy of the podcast, John Cryer. Maybe it's working with John Cryer. Maybe Ducky drives people insane.
Maybe it's Chaim Levine, showrunner.
But let me tell you what. Recently there was a video from Angus T. Jones. He plays the half a man on the show. And he was talking about how he had this religious awakening. And basically, he put this video out where he says that his show is filth. And he urges people not to watch it. Don't watch my show. And it's pissing me off. And I'll tell you why, Angus. This is why you're pissing me off. Because you work on the show. You've been working on the show, not just you, but with other actors and writers and people who work hard on this product. So how dare you come on this come and put a video online, some video online of you and your trailer, the trailer on the show in which you work on, and have the audacity to tell people, not that I watch your fucking show anyway, and don't worry, I know, but maybe I'll start because you don't want me to. So you know what, Angus T. Jones? Fuck you. You're the end of the podcast this week. Who does this? Who puts out a video? Don't watch my show.
How much is Angus T. Jones? Which, by the way, what kind of fucking name? I think that's a Groucho Marx name from one of his movies, Angus T. Jones. How much does Mr. Jones make per episode?
Mr. Jones, I don't know how he's making for episode, but by the way...
Can I tell you?
Do you know?
$300,000 an episode.
Get out of town. Nope. Really?
He's one of the highest paid actors on television.
Well, you know, he had a little bit the day after this went up. He goes, oh, no, God wants me to be on the show now. God wants me to be on the show.
His business manager wants him to be on the show.
Does God want you to be on the show, or the total of $8 million you're making off of the show want you to be on the show? Fuck you. This pisses me off. I hate when these people, they're on a prime, and then they're like, well, fuck that thing that I'm doing. No, other people work on this thing, too. In religious way, is he going to be our next Kirk Cameron? Am I going to have to deal with, for the rest of my life, him telling me how I can't wear a condom or something, or I can't jerk off in a teacup while watching American Horror Story?
Yeah.
Is he going to be doing this? What do you think of this half a man?
This is an interesting question. I have a funny joke to tell you, and then I'll tell you my answer, which is I'm working with Barry Corbin right now, who's on Anger Management. Right, Charlie Sheen's show. And I keep saying, I'm working with Barry Corbin. He's on Anger Management. And everybody keeps looking at me and going, well, what's he like to work with? You know, because they always think he's in Anger Management. And I said, no, he's on the show. You know, because you look at Barry and, you know, you can
look like a gruff guy.
He plays a real bad guy in Vicente Fernandez, and you never know. Like, you know, so I think that tickles me funny. But the personal aspect and relationship I have to this story, and I have not seen the story in terms of media. I have not seen the video.
Okay.
I've just heard proof of it. But the religious stuff that he's spouting is apparently from the Adventists.
Yes.
My wife is an Adventist. My wife was born and raised Seventh-day Adventist.
Okay.
And I happen to know for a fact that internally, within the Adventist community, they are trying to distance themselves as far and as fast from this guy as possible.
Oh, good.
Because they are not like that at all. You know, they're not zealots.
Like, if you watch 2.5 Men, you're going to hell.
No. And I know that her dad, for one, was furious about it. Was furious because it kind of tarnished the whole, tendril of that religion. You know, there's really, you know, they're really people that keep to themselves, and they really don't mind. You know, they're not out to convert. They don't have missions and stuff. Right. You know, stuff
fuck
like that.
Fuck you, Angus C. Jones. You're ruining a whole religion for people.
Yeah, Adventism, man. They're very nice guys. They're very nice people.
So, well, explain this. Explain. I don't know why I'm demanding you explain.
they observe kosher eating. They take their Sabbath on the Saturday, Friday night, Saturday night.
Okay. I take my Sabbath on the Saturday.
A lot of Old Testament observations.
I take my Sabbath.
They're the only religion recognized by the U.S. government as conscientious objectors.
Really?
Yeah. Not even the fucking Buddhists.
Well, he's a conscientious objector apparently from 2.5
Men. 2.5 Men. Mm-hmm. I think I think Chuck Lorre breaks all these people.
This is weird though, because you have Charlie Sheen, then you have this like people.
So the show's been on for like 9,000 years.
Just
people just burning out of the show.
Fucking show. Just end it.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe I heard Ashton Kutcher was playing Steve Jobs. I almost fell
over. Yeah, he's playing Steve Jobs in
but
a
it's
movie.
Jobs the fucking movie. The J is small and the OBS is in large letters.
Oh,
so it looks like
iPad.
iPad.
So you fuck you. Fuck you.
Listen, Noah Wiley played the quintessential Steve Jobs in Pirates of Silicon Valley.
Oh, that's right.
It's a good
TV movie. Yeah, I like that.
Well, come on, Sorkin's movie is going to be the definitive. So
well, you
what
know
are
how Sorkin's
we all screwing around
structured.
With this shit?
Sorkin's movie is going to be 5 scenes. From Steve Jobs' life. That's it. And each scene's going to be an extended 15 to 20 minute. They're going to be pivotal points in Steve Jobs' career.
Sounds great.
That's how the movie's going to be.
I mean, I'll see it.
Of course you will.
Of course I see everything.
I'm a huge Newsroom fan. You guys are not, I take it.
I like it a little more than him, but
you
I
think
have
it's a
big
bit soapboxy, don't you?
It's a mess.
Really?
It's a mess.
I like the show better than when it was called Countdown with Keith Olbermann. But that's just me. I feel like I'm just watching the news that I watched a year ago when I watched the news. And then people say, well, it's the news the way it should have been. I watch MSNBC. This is the way the news is every night for me.
Let me ask you a question. You stuck it out. You'll stick it out with something clumsy in its first season. Like, are you saying that the first season of Boardwalk Empire is better than the first
good.
Season of
it's
Newsroom?
I know it's good. The show's gotten stronger with each episode
yeah.
of the season.
But
right. But don't you think? I mean, you're talking about Sorkin, the guy
well,
who
the
wrote
reason
West for 5 years.
Movie, there's no story. There's no plot. The characters happen to be my problem, and I've talked about this before. We can talk about this more at length afterwards. My main problem with the show is that he is so obsessed with the idea of recontextualizing the news and the way that he idealizes it
right.
to the point where all the characters become secondary. It's as if it's like a burden to him that, I got
to
have characters. They have to have relationships. It's so perfunctory.
It has a legit female problem, too. These women are both asked to be... We're told they're geniuses, but they act like idiots.
They run around like idiots with chickens with their heads cut off, running around screaming and freaking out at
but
things.
Here's the thing. If I like the concept of a show, I'll give it a fair shake. So I watched the whole first season. And
you didn't think that show where they were trying to get in touch with that guy that was embedded in Afghanistan, and Dev Patel was trying to communicate with him over the computer and stuff. I thought that was so compelling, that episode.
You know what? No, actually, there's enough I like about the show that I watched the full season.
I think there's better uses of my time, better stuff on television.
Really?
Yeah.
I will scream and yell
and bang my fist on the table.
You will suffer through Newsroom, but you won't try an episode of American Horror Story?
I'll try it.
I know I would like American Horror Story. It's just a matter of between every movie I see, every movie I watch, if during the baseball season I'm watching baseball games, other TV shows I'm already watching, it's tough to fit in other shows. Mm. I'm actually excited that some shows I like are ending to free up some time in my schedule.
It's tricky.
Before we leave, I wanted to bring up, I always like to end
on... Can we talk about a fucking disaster? This season of Dexter.
I don't even watch that show.
You want to talk about disaster?
That show's been on a downward spiral since the third season.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
The John Lithgow season was excellent.
All right. Anyway.
I don't want...
Sorry.
Who's going to be the problem? Sorry. We're going to stop watching new shows, and then we're never going to be able to talk about TV again.
Sorry.
But I want to end with a little weird thing. There's a new study that shows that female porn stars have higher self-esteem than normal women.
Of course.
I found this very interesting, because you have this idea of porn stars that they're all like a sad mess. But this makes perfect sense, because they're actresses, so they're probably narcissists, and they're porn stars, they know they're being masturbated to on a daily basis, so they're desired. This makes perfect sense.
I don't know what you're talking about. I do not view women as sexual objects. They are all beautiful three-dimensional creatures full of thoughts, feelings, and emotions.
You're going to have to get off of this sooner or later.
Well, I'm trying to get... I was getting off on women. Now I had to get off getting off of women. Now I got to get off getting off of getting off of women.
We're trying to book a porn star for the show, too,
yeah,
by the way.
You should.
We want to have one.
You know, Susan Faludi writes extensively about this topic.
Who?
From a feminist writer.
I'm sorry?
Susan Faludi.
Oh. Sounds like a sex act.
Female porn stars... run the game. They are the boss.
In the porn world, not politically.
No, in the porn world.
Okay.
Yes. Even though they are demeaned sometimes, or depending on the scene, they can be, you know, degraded or humiliated on screen, they call every shot. When the camera's not rolling, the female porn star calls every single shot. Who they're going to suck, who they're going to fuck, who they're going to work with, who they're not going to work with, who's going to direct, who's going to stand there. They are the linchpin of the whole set.
Apparently, whose podcast they're going to do, too. Because we're finding this out, actually, a problem with female porn stars, where they're like, they're not necessarily as... They're so...
Everything's hustling for a buck.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's why we were trying to book someone. I'm not going to say who, but we're trying to book somebody, and it turned out they were like, "Well, do I get money on this?" And we're like, "No, you just have a good time and promote yourself on our show."
Right.
And now we're trying to find somebody else to book.
So I'm not surprised about the self-esteem. I'm not surprised about that comment.
Okay, I was a little. I want to know who did the research.
Well, so based on your description of a porn star, Ernest Borgnine, opposite of a porn star.
Opposite of a porn star.
Excellent.
Absolutely. Yeah.
But when I say the reason, I mean, that'd be a good job. You go around talking to porn stars, making them happy, finding out they're happy.
Right.
Oh, as a psychologist.
Yeah.
You know, collecting the data.
That you wouldn't be a stunt cock. Say.
Yeah.
You know what? Look, if they call upon me to be the stunt cock, I'm more than willing.
I had to take one for the team.
I had a calling, and it was to sleep with a bunch of porn stars.
We're shedding female listeners at a rapid pace.
No. This isn't that bad.
Hey, Alyssa, what's going on?
They only shedding. Believe me.
Bye.
It's gonna be well, you know.
Well, I'm not surprised to learn that. That's cool. What is the actual statistic?
It just says that they have higher self-esteem. They're very happy people.
They are they're good looking, and
they don't have money problems.
They're getting paid to have sex.
I'll tell you what,
they don't have health problems because they got to be tested and rigidly.
Now,
but you know what? You know what I find disturbing. If you want to keep on this subject of pornography,
I always do.
Didn't California pass the law that you have to wear
condoms? Yes,
which is a bullshit law, because adults should be able to. We've talked about this. Adults should be able to fuck without a condom if they want.
But they're talking about the adult film industry. They're talking about your home.
But at the same time, if two consenting adults want to have sex on film for money.
To quote George Carlin, when he talks about prostitution, he goes, "I don't get it. Fucking is legal. Selling is legal. Why isn't selling fucking legal?"
Do you disagree with the condom? I mean, do you think that they should wear condoms?
I think it's going to cause a lot of problems, because I can't help but imagine that that is part of the fetish.
Yeah, it's part of the fantasy. Yeah.
I mean, they're going to tear down a whole genre of pornography, I think.
I don't watch that much porn, but I'll be honest. I mean, obviously, I've watched porn. I don't know if I want to see people coming into condoms.
I mean, I could very well imagine a scenario where that is the deciding factor on where you spend your buck.
Oh, yeah.
That people would rather watch
unprotected sex than protected sex. You do realize the internet is chock-a-block full of free pornography.
Well, no, I understand, but I'm saying, you know, in a hypothetical model.
Right.
People who let's say you have $1 to spend on porn or whatever it is, right? You know, I think that the condom makes a difference for
it
people.
It does. It's just part of fantasy.
Just like white panties versus stockings makes a difference. You know, there's all sorts of different
arenas. I'm going to drive the industry out of California.
Double enemy of the podcast, condoms. Kids, don't wear condoms. Get rid of them.
Well, unless you're getting paid, I guess. I don't know.
And
on that note, Aaliyah.
Yes. Thank you for having me. You could be debasing my reputation as a Australian person.
Hey.
Now we're the man who shook the hand of Aaliyah.
Yeah, there you go.
So before we leave, tell us one more time. Is there also a website for the film? Is there how can we get more information, not only for it out in theaters now, but for the future when it comes to
the film's out there? You can Google it any time. You could go to my production company's website and link up through there.
What's that?
GoFilmatics.com.
GoFilmatics.
You could do that. You could you could like us on Facebook. That would be incredibly helpful.
And again, go to the Will Sean podcast. As we have liked them on Facebook. Go to our likes. Find them.
Bang.
Like them.
Bangity bang bang.
And go see the movie.
And go see
if you can't see
the
theater, if you don't live in Los Angeles.
You know what? You know what else is? Can I pimp it out a bit here? The soundtrack is out.
It's got great music.
Soundtrack is out on iTunes and all digital retailers. And Rui Folguera, who composed the soundtrack, apprenticed under Morricone.
Oh, wow.
So you're not going to get a more authentic Spaghetti Western score in this day and age than something like that. I mean, that's pretty
amazing.
Cool. Maybe Django Unchained. I don't know, because Quentin's pretty crazy.
That's probably just going to be all...
It's
going to
be
James Brown songs and stuff.
And needle drops. It's going to be his playlist.
Honestly, yeah. And like Sean was saying, if you don't live in Los Angeles, there will be other opportunities to see this film. So just
keep your eyes peeled.
And you let us know when more things happen with the film, and we'll keep posting it on the Facebook page.
Cool. And you let me know when I can come back for any silly excuse you have, because this was a blast.
Are you on Twitter?
I am on Twitter.
You can
follow the man who shook the hand of Vicente Fernandez. I believe. Is it me or is it the man who shook the hand?
You're both.
I'm both.
Can you give us your Twitter handle? I'm guessing you can't since you were unsure that you aren't.
Yeah, I don't even know my password. I mean, I tweeted last week, I guess. I'm not.
Just follow it on Facebook.
Yeah,
follow it
on Facebook. Find me. Tweet me. I'll tweet you. Don't worry. Don't stress.
Sean, do the thing where you plug your things.
Do it.
Triumvirs, Triumvirs. If you have an Amazon Prime and you own a Kindle, maybe you're getting a Kindle for the holidays, you can go and rent the book for free and read it for free, and I actually get a little coin when you do that. So go ahead and Amazon Prime, go on your Kindle, find the book, download it, give it a read, you'll like it. I'm working on some new material, hopefully should have a couple chapters of something out in the next, hoping the next 2 months or so, and still working on sterner stuff that will be coming out. I know everyone's forgotten about it, but I have not.
No, I mean, I'll give a shit when it's out.
Sounds good.
I love you like a brother. I'll give a shit when it's out.
And Facebook, The Sean David. Twitter, The Sean David. Also on Facebook. Like me, follow me, and letterpress and Instagram.
Hey, you dickhead. You can follow me at The Real Will Link. You can also listen to me review movies every Tuesday at 4 p.m. on the PM show with a Larry Minetti. Larry Minetti, who makes an appearance
Great face.
In The Man Who Shook the Hand.
Great face.
And you could listen to the Larry Minetti show at crntalk.com. You could also read reviews and articles like the one about what is the best film to watch as you're dying at can like the city in France, .com. On the show next week, we're very excited. We have a terrific stand-up comic coming on, Jake Weissman. He's very funny. He's going to be on. He's going to be telling us about, it's that clip going around where you see where he busts a heckler for having coke on him. He dragged this heckler up on stage.
It's making the rounds on the internet.
He was performing his stand-up act. Some guy was heckling him. He made the guy come on stage to kind of try to humiliate him. Found coke on the guy.
Right.
Got the guy to leave because he told him the cops were coming for him. It's great. We're going to hear all that story, and he's a really funny guy. It should be a fun episode.
Did you see that viral video about the guy that went up and did a bunch of Asian jokes in front of an Asian crowd, and they jumped up on stage and kicked his ass?
No.
Oh, well, there you go.
I'm going to Google that one. I want to get that guy on. Yeah. I want to get the racist guy on talking about how he hates Asians.
Oh, you'd be Tommy Ching Chong?
It was incredibly awkward.
And then the week after that, to close out the year, because the year's coming to an end, to close out the year, we're going to have a terrific cartoonist named Lonnie Millsap. He's got a new book of his cartoons out called I Stepped on a Duck.
Quack.
Oh, cool.
Very funny cartoons. He's going to come on, and that's going to be an interesting world for us to talk about, too, because we haven't gotten into that. And in the meantime, we are working not only just on that porn star, but we're looking at some big guests for early next year. We got some comics that we're talking to. We got some
actors.
You know, we got the people out there. People will be coming on. It'll be great.
And mid-January is our 50th episode, our quarter quell.
Yeah, we got a big 50th episode planned. We got the Oscars coming up next year, too. We're going to be doing Oscars. Oh, it's almost too much podcast for you to handle.
You know what? Fuck this. I'm going to LACMA. I got to go look at some porcelains.
Yeah, look at some Kubrick. Yeah.
Go see the film. Go.
Be excellent to each other.
Love one another.
Right. Party on, dude.
And on that note,
we're finished.
We're finished.